From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. While many Americans scanned websites and superstore aisles for Black Friday deals, and others recovered from Thanksgiving food comas, the Trump administration released a major new report on climate change. The 1,600-page National Climate Assessment comes from the U.S. Global Change Research Program. That's a consortium of 13 federal agencies, including the Department of Defense, the EPA, and NASA. And the news is not good for a number of industries, including Georgia agriculture. Kim Cobb is a climate scientist and director of the Global Change Program at Georgia Tech, and she's joining us in the studio with some key takeaways. Hello, Kim.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Michael Wall also is here with us. He's a seventh-generation farmer and director of farmer services at Georgia Organics. Hello, Michael.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Kim, I'm going to start with you because you've studied climate change and climate science, rather, for 20 years. This report delves into the human and economic consequences of climate change. How does it anticipate the global climate change over the next several decades?
Yeah, so our emissions trajectories are on course to warm the planet by up to 8 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. But of course, it's much more than just the average temperature associated with global warming that is a concern. As the report indicates, it really comes with a host of very negative and disruptive impacts to social and ecological systems that will really hit home. In fact, some of them is already, of course, hitting home here in Georgia and beyond.
So extreme weather, hot weather, cold weather, more rare?
Yeah, so obviously we're facing prospects for increase in heat waves, which is, of course, a more direct consequence of that warming, as well as some indicators for more widespread drought, as well as extreme precipitation. Those are the kind of key impacts that may hit the agricultural sector specifically. But, of course, other concerns here are coastal sea level rise, projections for multiple feet of sea level rise, an extreme scenario up to 8 feet by the end of the century. And so obviously indicating that there are many indicators already showing us that climate change is occurring today, a number of negative impacts landing on our doorstep, and of course projected to increase going forward over the next decades.
And of course, behind all of those projections are also human costs. And the executive summary of this lengthy report opens with a focus on communities and within that on vulnerable populations. Who does the report say will be most acutely impacted by climate change?
Yeah, well, this is one of the highlights, I think, from this report and the main takeaways from this report, and distinguishes it from many other climate reports in taking it down to that community level and really emphasizing the fact that the frontline communities are going to be those that are economically underserved and disadvantaged already, including minority populations across this country. And they will bear by far the largest cost of these climate impacts. And something to keep in mind as we weigh decisions around investments and protecting communities today to increase their resilience, not just today, but going forward, as an important solution set for climate change.
How and why those populations in particular affected?
Well, it really is about access to resources and adaptability. And so we've seen already from the recent spate of natural disasters related to Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Florence, that those folks whose homes are destroyed can't rebuild in a day. They can't rely on savings that they have accumulated. So it's really just about access to resources. And you really need that to be as resilient as you can. And so those communities will bear the brunt.
Have these government reports in the past placed so much emphasis on the human cost of climate change?
Well, I think historically we focus more on the physical climate impacts. But I think what highlights really in particular about this report is that it provides communities with a blueprint for action to protect themselves today and going forward. And so you see just written throughout this report, here are some concrete ways that are regionally informed, this precise impacts that science tells us will be coming down to these communities and really allows them to take a hard look at their decisions and in some concrete ways that they can protect themselves today and going forward.
I want to get to those, certainly, but the report also very quickly, beyond communities, gets to the economic implications of climate change. How is climate change projected to affect the country's GDP?
Yes. So with the anticipated spate of impacts that are outlined in the report, it's important to note that no American will be spared from these economic damages in one way or another. And of course, some of the heaviest hit sectors are going to be the coastal real estate sector, agriculture across the nation as well. And so obviously health impacts, too, according to the report. All of this may amount to as much as 10% of GDP by 2100. You're talking hundreds of billions of dollars in damages year in and year out in some specific sectors. So this price tag, we're already feeling it. I think all Americans understand we're already feeling the true costs of climate change today. But this report indicates that those costs are going to escalate quite dramatically going forward and really pose some tough challenges for communities.
Along the coast, public infrastructure, $1 trillion in national wealth held in real estate threatened by rising sea levels, flooding, storm surges. Michael, let's get to you and dig into those Georgia numbers a little bit. Your job with Georgia Organics takes you to dozens of farms throughout the year. Seventh generation farmer yourself. The report notes that agricultural production and other agricultural-related sectors contribute billions of dollars and millions of jobs to the U.S. economy, but also projects the end of this century, over half a billion labor hours could be lost from extreme heat-related impacts in the South. What would that do to Georgia's industry of agriculture?
It's a little hard to relate to what half a billion dollars worth of lost labor would mean. It's a kind of a communication gap that farmers would have a hard time dealing with. But it sounds like it means it's going to get harder and harder to farm. And that could have devastating impacts on the state's number one industry, which is what agriculture is. I would argue it's the state's most important industry. We all have to eat. And dealing with extreme heat like that, I think farmers are inherently a resilient bunch. They have a very close relationship with Mother Nature. They're going to take it a day at a time, a season at a time, and a year at a time. So it's really hard to estimate what kind of impact it's going to have on agriculture, unless we just say it's going to be really bad, which is what it sounds like.
So we hear these big numbers, as you said. It's hard for people to understand, but they do understand heat, rain, lack of rain. It's not just increased heat and increased drought associated with it that scientists project will expect to hurt farmers, rather. It's rain, of all things, in the form of extreme precipitation events. And we saw one such event with Hurricane Michael in October, last year with Irma. What do precipitation extremes do to farmland?
Flood them. Extreme lack of precipitation. There's no crops. Crops die. And these are things that are part of a farmer's reality right now. So they deal with this idea, this concept, on a yearly basis. If they're not dealing with too much water, they're dealing with too little water already. So this is something that's part of farming. I think a farmer would say that. This sounds bad, but until I see it, I don't know what to do about it. They're just going to take it day at a time. That's the farmer's way.
And farmers are also used to these kind of cycles, however. For you, your family's been farming for many generations. Many farmers in Georgia have been farming for many generations. Have they seen this before?
The conversation was going on for a long time, and especially when climate change first came out, and then when it first got political, it was a lot more obvious that farmers were skeptics. And I haven't heard that skepticism in a while. Mm. And I think it really started in 2013 when you had those deep freezes. Then they were almost exactly 6 months apart. That had never happened from Atlanta upward before. And then the summer before that, you had record levels of hot soil, which that affects every single crop. So the researchers, UGA scientists, and the farmers were all going, this is weird. I don't know if it's climate change, but it's something. And now that I haven't heard any farmers say anything that was skeptical of climate change in a long time.
So a new government report on climate change predicts transformations in life as we know it in Georgia, impacting human health and the economy and agriculture and infrastructure. So we're talking about that with a climate scientist and a farmer, some of the people who are looking at and feeling what it would be like to experience that. Kim, you mentioned events already happening on the ground, wildfires, extreme weather. Are these conclusive? Exclusively linked, however, to climate change. I've noticed scientists have reeled back from saying this is the cause.
Well, I think that the science is pretty clear that there are already a fingerprint of climate change in these natural disasters. I mean, these wildfires are record-breaking in California. We've had record-breaking hurricane seasons in the very recent years. And the science is getting stronger and stronger in helping us to understand that we're already seeing these impacts and that these are the kinds of impacts that have always been predicted by the models for climate change. And so when the report emphasizes that we need to move towards climate readiness, this is exactly what they mean. We're already so vulnerable to these types of natural disasters. When you load the dice with climate change, you can expect worse statistics going forward, worse disasters going forward. And so we have an opportunity to use this information to protect American lives and protect American property right now in the process, make ourselves healthier and wealthier.
Well, it also has something for everyone, you know, people in cities, farmers, rural communities, and Georgians on the coast. So what are some of the report's key messages about coastal environments?
Yeah, so coastal environments, of course, particularly vulnerable with ongoing sea level rise associated with ocean warming and, of course, the melting of ice sheets, as well as, of course, these storm surges that have become all too recent over the last several years, really illustrating the critical vulnerabilities when you layer up these challenges, which are only going to continue to get worse in terms of threats to coastal communities. And so coastal communities make up, of course, the vast majority of the U.S. population and of course, close to half of the GDP in the U.S. So this is a huge amount of wealth and prosperity and human lives that are on the line right here.
You've been working with communities throughout Georgia with the Georgia Tech Smart Sea Level Sensors Project. Now, what is that?
Yeah, so I'm very excited about that. I think it's one of the kinds of solutions that the report outlines. It pairs scientists and engineers from Georgia Tech with governmental officials and community partners down on the ground in Savannah, Georgia. These are communities that know that they face acute near-term and long-term risks associated with sea level rise, especially during emergencies like hurricane landfalls. And so the idea is to instrument the coast with internet-able sea level sensors to provide real-time information about what the water level is and what kinds of critical infrastructures are vulnerable in real time to help emergency responders. And it's been wonderful to just see the momentum that is built behind this project, both here at Georgia Tech and also down on the coast. A community is just very happy to know that we're down there working to build resilience and add capacity to their coastal flooding risks.
And some of the specifics here, there is ocean acidification, which is an effect of climate change, already killing off shellfish and corals, red tides, algae blooms, depleting oxygen in the water and can kill sea life. I'm just reading some of the highlights from this report. So how have the local communities responded to this project?
So when we're down there installing sea level sensors, and this is with my partner, Russ Clark, who's also faculty here at Georgia Tech, and he and the folks from the Chatham Emergency Management Agency have been installing these sensors down in communities, and people come up and ask them, well, why are you doing installing that thing on the bridge? Looks a little suspect. When we tell people what we're doing, the number one thing that we hear is, thank you. Thank you for working with us. Thank you for protecting our communities. And it doesn't matter what political stripe you are, you're happy to see Georgia Tech researchers down there in your community working to protect you.
Well, stay with us, Kim and Michael. We're going to be looking at more of the effects and more of that political stripe that you just mentioned for this new climate report. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought. The fourth in a series of government reports mandated by Congress was released on Friday. The National Climate Assessment lays out some dire predictions of what climate change will do to the U.S., and more specifically to the Southeast. I'm speaking about that report with Georgia Tech climate scientist Kim Cobb. We've also been speaking with Michael Wall. He's director of farmer services for Georgia Organics. Now, Kim, it was the day before Thanksgiving and 2 days before this report's release that President Donald Trump tweeted, "Brutal and extended cold blast could shatter all records. Whatever happened to global warming? But when he visited Georgia after Hurricane Michael, he had this conversation with a reporter in the press pool.
Last night in your comments about climate change, you said that there is something there, and previously in the past you've called it a hoax. What changed your mind?
There's something there. There's no question. There is something there, man-made or not. I mean, there's something there, and it's going to go, and it's going to go back and forth, but there is something there. But again, 50 years ago it was brutal. 1890s were brutal. You have different times.
Now, you, Kim, you study the climate and natural and human-made mechanisms of global climate change. Any way to tell how much of this is naturally shifting weather patterns and how much is from human emissions?
Yes, so there's report after report after report, of course supported by all the major national academies across the world, that humans are responsible for almost 100% of the warming over the last several decades. And this is clearly laid out in the recent National Climate Assessment, as well as supported by vast troves of thousands of papers from the literature, including my own work studying the climate extremes and trends of the pre-industrial period compared to today.
Michael, you, as you said, you've spoken with a lot of farmers on the ground, people who don't necessarily, they're climate skeptics, or let's say that they're skeptical about the role of human beings in climate change, but they have, they're seeing what they're seeing on the ground.
Yeah.
What is the argument for them? Do you think it makes more sense to see what's actually happening or economic projections? What translates best for the farmers that you work with?
I think what translates best is what they see, what's happening to their bottom line, what's happening to their farm production. Right now would not be a good time to talk to farmers in Southwest Georgia about this report. I know many of them.
Because they're cleaning up still from Hurricane Michael?
They're devastated from Michael. They don't know when they're going to get a check again. They're probably still getting trees off their houses or their crops. Or if they're tractors, that's still a reality in Southwest Georgia. So it's tempting to use this as an opportunity to talk about climate change, but I certainly wouldn't do that right now.
Yeah, well, one way that people have chosen to address climate change is by eating different foods, right? Absolutely. Can you tell us about how what we eat and where we get our food is tied up in that?
Sure. Kim mentioned climate readiness, and I think that's something organic farmers are dealing with now. They're mulching, they're rotating their crops, they're using low-till methods, and they're using cover crops. So all of those things would be good for like an extreme drought situation. And those are things that organic farmers are already doing. And to the consumer's end, I think, you know, we're a society where almost all of us are wearing something on our wrists that tell us how many steps we've taken. And, you know, we're doing things that are really healthy for ourselves. But I think we can start thinking about taking a couple of other steps that can also benefit the entire community, and that includes organic farmers in Georgia. So making healthy food choices that tie back directly to a farmer that you know who's using organic practices, you're fighting climate change with every bite when you're doing that, and usually it's going to be a much tastier, more enjoyable experience.
For you, Kim, you were talking about resilience. You were talking about readiness. It's pretty clear that we're not going to get people. You know, people are not going to stop taking trains. Planes. They're not going to stop driving in cars. So where do we go with this in terms of readiness and fighting climate change or keeping the tide back?
So there are a couple things. I think we really have to remember that climate solutions is not just about drawing down our emissions. Climate solutions is about preparing our communities for climate challenges today and, of course, becoming more resilient to those coming in the future. And so that's too quickly brushed over. Michael notes that it's never a really great time to talk about climate change, but this report gives us an opportunity to really translate some of these impacts into community discussions around readiness and what they can do to protect themselves going forward. And so I really don't want to leave that off the table, especially important here in Georgia, where climate change can be the third rail. It doesn't have to be. These are actionable, real tangible, concrete actions that communities can take today.
Well, it's a conversation that's been going on for 20, 25 years, longer in some circles, but certainly in the mainstream, this idea of like, is it too late? Can we turn back? And always the message is, no, we can do something. What do you think? Is there a tipping point?
I mean, you know, as I'm fond of saying, it's not a pass-fail here. What we're going for is really trying to reduce the risk that we're baking in going forward. So, but in doing so, we have to recognize we already have some clear and present risks that we have to face on a community level. And so there's a lot of actions that communities can take both to adapt to the impacts today and reduce the emissions trajectories that they're responsible for going forward. And so in the absence of federal action in this space, we have seen a groundswell of activity at these different levels. So community levels, state levels, regional actions, people coming together to try to tackle these very steep challenges with growth of emissions. And that is extremely heartening as a climate scientist to see that folks are out there aggressively moving towards a different way of life. We know it needs to happen.
Kim Cobb, she's climate scientist at Georgia Tech and director of Tech's Global Change Project. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Wall is with us also. Thank you so much. He's a seventh-generation farmer and director of farmer services for Georgia Organics.
Thanks.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, we know this is On Second Thought, and we've got another guest here for us. Black and Latinx workers continue to be underrepresented in STEM fields, and that is science, technology, engineering, and math. Black workers make up only 9% in those STEM fields. And to diversify STEM fields, the National Science Foundation is turning to the nation's historically Black colleges and universities. It gave Morehouse College a $1.5 million grant to head up the effort. Lycurgus Muldrow is executive director of Morehouse's HBCU Identity Research Center for STEM. That is an impressive title.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, we like the title, too.
Diversity aside, STEM industries have had trouble getting qualified workers in general. What is the overall challenge?
Well, let's start from how big the deficit is. Some people say that there's possibly a million more jobs that's needed than students in the pipeline. It starts in K through 12. Children in the United States don't like STEM. There are studies that's done in which we talk to children in the United States and other nations, and children in the United States say, science is hard, math is hard. Students in other countries, like China, for example, where they have more honor students than we actually have students, period, they say, you know, science and math, that's the key to the future. They really have an intrinsic motivation to pursue that. So national reports make statements like, out of 71 nations, United States ranks 38 in actual math competence of the students, ranks 24 in science competence. So basically speaking, starting from K through 12, we just don't have an education system that values STEM. We don't have a system that values education enough.
Well, that is something that educators have been focusing on for a long time. STEM education, it seems like it's been the sort of driving force for the past decade or so. But how about in particular in diverse populations, in African-American schools, in Latino schools, where already it's a challenge to help students graduate in some cases? They're not as well resourced. So how is this grant that you have at Morehouse going to reach back and help sort of make a difference in all of those problems?
The Identity Research Center is geared to develop an intrinsic identity. For instance, if a student sees themselves as a scientist, that's their identity. If they see themselves with an identity that I'm resilient and doesn't matter what happens to me, I'm going to get up and keep on going, then the probability of that student being successful increases. For example, in the United States, 50% of all students that start a STEM major finish a STEM major. In the African-American community, only 25% of African-Americans that start a STEM major finish a STEM major. So the whole work on identity, resilient identity, STEM identity, has been going on for many, many years, but there's not a lot of data that really brings in best practices how to engender a resilient STEM identity. And there's very, very little work that's done with African-Americans or specifically in HBCUs. Mm-hmm. So we're developing a whole model to try to figure out what are the best practices? How do we create a growth mindset. A mindset is, you know, I have grit. I'm going to work hard. I realize my work is going to determine how successful I am. How do we develop an identity that's a resilient identity? It said, well, it doesn't matter what obstacles I have. It doesn't matter if I came from a first-generation college student. I came from a school system where the vast majority of students are on free and reduced lunch, economically disadvantaged. It doesn't matter of that background. I understand what I'm facing, and I'm going to make it regardless.
So this goes far beyond STEM to, you know, in the absence of models, creating a resilient student population. So now this is not Morehouse alone trying to diversify the STEM workforce. You are at the helm of a national effort. Is that correct?
We're at the helm of a national effort that 1.5 million can turn into 9 million in another 2 years. We're working, Morehouse is the lead in this project, but we're working with right now already, we just got funding in August, we're working with 20 HBCUs already. Our goal is to impact at least 50 HBCUs. Not only are we implementing different programs that are proven that were developed at Morehouse to actually work in terms of increasing grit, increasing a growth mindset, we are studying a large number of implementations that will ultimately give us a theoretical model. This is the best practice for creating STEM resilient identity.
Now, part of your job is encouraging students to develop that drive to work in STEM fields beyond the resilience, just to take on any challenge. Is that something, you know, for you? How did that play out in your own college career?
Well, I'm sort of an interesting study.
We all are.
When I was in high school, my only interest was to play football. And I went out for football, was terrible at it. So I worked hard, I exercised year round, I did everything I could do. And by the time I graduated from high school, I was one of the top football players in Northeastern section of North Carolina. So when I decided to go to college, I told my father, you know, I'm not going to play football, but I'm going to be an honor roll student. Now, graduating from high school, I had a C-minus average. I kept a C-minus just so that I could stay on the football team. But I realized through football that if I work hard, if I stick to it, if I stay in the midst of what I need to do, I can be successful. So I went to college reading at the seventh grade level, and I graduated 14th in my graduating class and got a full scholarship, actually a Ford Foundation scholarship to go to any graduate school in a PhD program. Obviously, I got my PhD.
Wow. So, but it's one thing if you are driving to become a football star and you're out there on the field and people are cheering for you and you're getting all this positive reinforcement. It's a little different than when you're sitting there grinding through your physics homework.
So part of the thing that we're doing is we got to get away from that. The reality of it is STEM is taught messed up in the United States. STEM is taught like, what's the history of science? What did other people discover? This dude is cookie-cutter lab that, you know the end of the results. You just want to see it work. Now, one of the projects we're doing that we're studying is course-based undergraduate research. In other words, let the students come in and do real research in their course, do real discovery in their course. It's like taking an art major and saying, we're going to teach you about the history of art and give you a degree. Oh, they're going to leave that major. They want to draw. They want to paint. They want to sculpt. So in these courses, so we're doing, Dr. Larry Bloomer is an expert in this. One of the courses we're doing, for example, is phage hunters. An introduction biology course, the students go out and try to discover new viruses that infect bacteria. And if they happen to find one, and they get send off and get the DNA sequence of it, and they do informatics, and if they bioinformatics, which is studying the DNA in the computer, and if they find one, they can publish it. So now what's happening, I see myself as a scientist. I'm doing real research. This is what science is about. You create the identity. You create everybody in the sidelines cheering on when the faculty says, wow, you got a publication as a freshman.
Lycurgus, you mentioned that it goes way back to K-12 and our general education system. So you are also working in this program with high school students, some in Morehouse's pre-freshman bridge summer science program, some in Clayton County public schools. How do these high school programs address some of the barriers in STEM education with so much time passed already?
So actually, I have a number of different grants. The center is only one. So right now, I have a very, very active program going on with 100 middle school students. And it's, this one is funded by Verizon. And what we do is bring them in a summer program all day, you know, during the summer, as well as during the academic year on given Saturdays. We teach them coding, but through creating little gadgets that they can wear. We teach them 3D printing. We teach them identity, for example, with the growth mindset. There are certain characteristics that a person has with a growth mindset. So we asked them in a workshop, what are some of the characteristics of superheroes, black superheroes? And then when they give us that, then we say, those are the characteristics that you need to have in STEM. So we teach them at their level. So what happens if you come to where a student is, give them things that's fun, virtual reality, they're creating virtual reality, then all of a sudden they see themselves as doing this. They realize that this is viable, I can do this, they have success with it, and they have the right mindset and identity to go for.
All right, Kim and Michael are still around the table. I think we all want to join this program so far. Lycurgus Muldrow, he's executive director of the HBCU Identity Research Center for STEM. That's at Morehouse College. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, coming up, we're going to hear more innovations in mentorship and getting kids through school and how people in Georgia are combating the Georgia dropout rate. It is Giving Tuesday, after all, and we've got some great nonprofits who are representing and helping kids make it. This is On Second Thought. We'll be back with that right after the break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. She began her career at CNN as an entry-level desk assistant and worked her way up to become chief international anchor for the network. Christiane Amanpour, of course. She's made a career out of telling other people's stories. Well, we'll hear hers tomorrow during On Second Thought. So join us live for that at 9 a.m. or listen on your own schedule to OST On Demand. Georgia's high school graduation rate continues to increase. The Department of Education says for the second year in a row, the state's graduation rate is above 80%. Innovative mentorship programs have helped. And to learn more, we're turning to a couple of leaders in the field. We've got Kimberlyn Bolton. She's Operation Director from Reimagine ATL. Hello, Kimberlyn.
Hi, Virginia. How are you today?
Very well. Really glad to have you all here. And Phil Olalie.
That's right.
Is Executive Director of Next Generation Men and Women. Welcome.
Thanks, Virginia.
Well, thanks so much for being here. And Phil, it's such an interesting origin story for Next Generation Men and Women, started by teachers. How'd it come together?
Yeah, so Next Generation Men and Women was founded by three regular educators here in the Atlanta space who just saw a need for providing positive exposure to work environments and professionals for underserved students, particularly young men of color at the time. Mm-hmm. And just the very real socioeconomic barriers that just make it more difficult to graduate, let alone achieve some degree of post-secondary success. So they started by just piloting a program, you know, pulling in partners, local companies, corporations, and physically bringing students into these spaces to interact with professionals and just start to stretch their imaginations around what's possible, what's out there in the Atlanta space, but realized that it wasn't enough. Exposure wasn't enough. It was great in terms of being able to have targets or goals, but how do I get there? And so Next Generation was really built on this premise that if we can provide exposure to diverse career pathways, professionals, work environments, and couple it with regular professional support, we can create a pathway to success for our students to not only graduate, but to be ready and committed to college or career.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that exposure. We just heard from Lycurgus about the idea of modeling, you know, seeing people in your field. So how do students see people who are working in the fields that they want to work in or don't even know they want to work in?
Yeah, I mean, exposure is everything. We really operate from a mindset that in order to become something, you have to experience it. And in order to experience it, you have to see it. And so what we do is we have a pretty intensive after-school program that forms student cohorts starting in the ninth grade. And so we have 15 to 20 young men and young women who start off in the ninth grade and really focus on personal identity, team cohesion, exploring post-secondary pathways. And then the second half of that program model is building a plan. And so throughout the twice a week after school sessions that are being facilitated by teachers on site and college undergraduates throughout the Metro Atlanta area, they're taking what we call exposure experience trips to a variety of different companies, organizations, and college campuses just to see what's out there in terms of industries, to interact with different sets of professionals, with who come from all different stripes, backgrounds, orientations, job functions. And for them, it's so eye-opening because they rarely have access to know what's out there. And to see themselves in these spaces is such a confidence booster for our youth.
Kimberlyn, how about for you at Reimagine ATL? How does that program connect kids to mentors?
Yes. So Reimagine ATL was founded 4 years ago by Susanna Specia with a mission to equip the next generation of storytellers. And we have a vision of a more safe, inclusive, and equitable workforce in the film and digital media industry. And so we do that with a three-point strategy. We do that by exposing, developing, and placing students within the film and digital media industry. And through our exposure, we host several different workshops throughout the year, ones that are free, ones that are at a nominal fee that just show the students the different types of careers that you can have in the film industry. Because what we saw was a lot of the times we were going into the schools and talking to them about the careers that exist, and they would say actor or producer or director. And we were like, no, there's so many opportunities, and there's so many different ways that you can work in this industry. And that's our number one goal, is to show them that all of these different careers exist in this one industry.
So why the storytelling hook? What is that about? What's the connection there?
Yeah, sure. The storytelling came from our founder again, who grew up in Alpharetta, Georgia, and she was just really discouraged because she didn't grow up seeing other people that did not look like her, didn't look the same as her. And so she wanted to create an environment where students could come together from all different backgrounds, all different races, all different socioeconomic status, and just come together with a common way to tell their story. She believed that everyone had a story. So if we could come together and share our stories and share our experience, we could really create empathy.
So let's hear one story. Tell me about a kid. You don't have to say a last name, especially to protect a child's identity. But, somebody who came into the program who discovered something and what they discovered.
Yeah, so one of my favorite stories to tell is we're currently working in one of the non-traditional high schools here in Atlanta. And those of you that know what non-traditional high schools are, it's an alternative high school where students are sent for bad behavior and they're written off, and their voices aren't heard, and no one really wants to hear what they're going through. And so one of our students started our program, and he was very closed off. And as we began to implement social emotional learning skills like meditation and improv, he was able to open up. And so in his exit interview, he said that for the first time, he felt like someone really heard him. Mm. Someone really cared about what he was experiencing. And he really found a way to channel his anger and to channel his frustration through the activities and through the programming that we were doing.
So did they, in the end, make something? Did they become part of a production?
Yes. At the end of the program, they were able to produce their own documentaries and, in fact, tell their own stories so that they're not having their stories told for them.
And Phil, I know that's part of the focus for you all is the quiet middle, the student in the quiet middle. What does that mean exactly?
So for us, we define the quiet middle as any student who is oftentimes overlooked for enrichment activities, or who is kind of off in the back of the classroom, needs an additional nudge or just some motivation to just be activated as a student. And so we have found that these are the students that have so much potential and promise, but are really not targeted or given the attention that they need. So we find a lot of value in pairing, creating these student cohorts that are comprised of quiet middle students, allowing them to learn from one another, in addition to the mentorship, counsel, direction that they're receiving from the teachers and college students who are working with them twice a week.
How do you find them? Do the teachers identify them?
The teachers know who they are. Mm-hmm. They're usually silent. They're off in the back of the classroom. They don't jump at opportunities to get involved in student groups or extracurriculars. And so, again, when we're talking about susceptibility to challenges, barriers, influences, these are the students who are more susceptible to those challenges and barriers.
And you mentioned before that the after-school program is teachers and college students. Are these all volunteers?
So we contract work out to teachers and our college students. And
yeah,
so,
I wondered about that because it seems like teachers have so much to do already. Isn't that part of the thinking?
Many, many balls in the air. But for us, we wanted to have a resource on the ground that was easily accessible for our students. And so we saw so much value in having someone who understands the lay of the land, amenities, resources on site, but then coupling that with a college student who is only a few years removed from our high school students in terms of thinking about that next step, that next chapter, preparing some sort of plan for making it to high school and beyond, and then being able to access the necessary resources and support to successfully do that.
That's Phil Olalilie. I'm so sorry.
Olalilie.
Olalilie.
Got, yeah.
You know, I had it before the show. Olalilie, he's executive director of Next Generation Men and Women. And Kimberly Bolton is with us. She's operations director for Reimagine ATL. They're both really innovative mentorship programs, kind of taking new tacks and new ways of exposing students. And I think exposing is really the key here. What do we know data-wise? I don't know if either of you have it on the top of your head, but I was in the airport, you know, over the weekend and saw a commercial about what mentoring does. What do we know about what mentoring does for kids?
Well, in terms of the value proposition of mentorship, I don't have any specific data points to present out. But we do know in terms of high school graduation, post-secondary attainment, the populations that suffer most or that are more often left behind are populations of youth who are face some sort of socioeconomic barrier, or Black and Brown youth. And so 2016-2017 school year, there are roughly 8,700 high school students who did not graduate, and roughly 84 high school graduates who did not attain a post-secondary pathway within 16 months of having graduated. And that's significant because we know in today's workforce, without having some higher education experience, some sort of post-secondary certification or a training under your belt, it's hard to be competitive in the workforce. It's hard to be gainfully employed. And so when we're thinking about a city that works for all, we have to develop everyone in order to be competitive, in order to provide real on-ramps for all to
just attain, right?
Just a quality life.
Now, you work in Title I schools, so these are student populations that are at least 40% low income, receive federal funds. So a lot of great challenges beyond just getting through school for a lot of kids, a lot of basic needs not met. Your organization based in Atlanta, and of course, Kimberlyn, you're working with the film industry and the media industry, so also in Atlanta. Do we know about Title I school challenges? Are they different in rural areas?
It's interesting because we work mainly with the Atlanta metropolitan area, but I have been talking with organizations who do work with schools in the rural areas, and they face similar opportunities and issues because there's just no representation mm-hmm. available out there. And so I think it comes down to a matter of representation. And when you talk about mentorship, what in our experience, when students can see people that look like them or come from where they come, be successful and excel in the space that they want to excel in, it really, really matters. Being someone from a small town in Connecticut, we didn't have a whole lot of celebrities or a whole lot of successful people come from that space. But to be able to see someone who looked like me and to see someone who could come from the same place do what I want to do was so, so important. And so that's one thing we try to stress, especially with the mentorship, is to allow our students to see those people excel in those areas.
How do you get buy-in? You obviously have to have buy-in from corporate partners, people who are in the industry, who are scuttling around doing their own thing, letting kids in and working with them, seeing them, mentoring them, which is a one-on-one. Is that correct?
Our mentorship, our particular form of mentorship looks very different. We do have one-on-one. We have a lot of group mentorship and a lot of job shadowing opportunities that we have available. But it's a really good question that you ask because a couple of years ago, the Arthur and Blank Family Foundation, they've been supporting us for a while. They came to us and they said, you know, we really love what you guys are doing. We see that you're really providing the workforce development training for the students. We see that you're creating this pipeline to place students directly into the industry. However, we'd love to see more support from the industry to do this. And so what they did was they gave us a multi-year grant to help leverage the film and entertainment industry so that they could help support what it is we're doing. And so at the beginning of 2017, we launched the Reimagine ATL Alliance. And it's a network of companies within the film and entertainment industry who come together and say, I understand the mission and I understand and believe in the vision of a more safe, inclusive, and equitable workforce. And so not only will we invest financially, but we will invest with more career exposure opportunities for your students. We will stand there. We will be mentors. We will provide education. We will provide resources for your students.
So for you, Phil, you just got an ambitious X grant, right? Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
But I'm curious, where you mentioned something about kids going on to post-secondary school or secondary school educations. Not everybody is built for that. How do you work with students who aren't necessarily college bound?
I think our position is to provide options. And so we're agnostic. We're not tracking students to four-year institutions or colleges. We're not tracking them to your vocational or technical schools. We are simply saying these are the opportunities and possibilities that exist out in the workforce and out in the world beyond high school, and providing them with a representative sample of what's out there so that they can exercise their own agency to pick and choose what's right for them. So if it does look somewhere in the flavor of, you know what, I want to pursue this 13-month apprenticeship program with an automotive factory. It's our job to provide them with information on what that path entails in terms of wages earned, in terms of a career path for them. And if they choose to still pursue that, we're going to back them 110%.
I'm wondering about the transition for you. We've just got a minute and a half left. You said you started out working with African-American young men and have since transitioned to include women. What was behind that decision?
For us, it's just realizing that these challenges aren't just affecting our young men. These are deep barriers and challenges that are holding back progress and success for our young women as well. And so it was unfair for our organization to be providing these opportunities and resources exclusively to young men without providing those to also to our young women who are interested in learning and just gaining exposure to the professional world, higher education, and then having the support to access and attain a post-secondary pathway of their choosing.
Well, you both have made tremendously good cases for your organizations. How about your Giving Tuesday? Where can people help, Phil?
Sure. Giving Tuesday, we would appreciate any and all support. You can visit our website at nextgenatl.org. Our social media hashtags are at nextgenatl. And again, if you are someone who lacked certain exposure or support growing up and see value in creating these opportunities for youth, please get behind our work.
Okay, Kimberly, 10 seconds.
Yes, and you can visit us at www.reimagineatl.com, click join and donate.
Kimberly Bolton, she's Operations Director at Reimagine ATL. Thank you. Phil Olallier, he is Executive Director of Next Generation Men and Women. That's all we have time for today. Give generously. It's Giving Tuesday, and be back tomorrow with more on Second Thought.